Good morning, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, following the remarkable encounter with the angel that night, we find Jacob feeling helpless, finally realizing his own weakness and crying with tears and supplication to God for his strength to be made perfect in weakness. Unable to do anything, finally, in his life except trust and plead with God and to cling to that angel that had been with him all his life. And in that state, brethren and sisters, we find Jacob moving now to meet Esau. And he finds that God has commanded deliverances for Jacob, as Psalm 44 says. And he saw the face of Esau there, as though he had seen the face of God himself. It's a remarkable illustration of the way God works in our lives, brethren and sisters. Because there's so many things that we can identify with this man. And after a very short time there that he spent with Esau, and Esau trying to encourage him to come back to Seir where he was, and Jacob saying, no, we will just come on softly. We will come at our own pace. We don't need any assistance. We find that Esau and Jacob part ways. Esau to his own. And we never see him again apart from the record that he came up to bury his father. It was a man of the flesh that went to Edom and there stayed and lived out his days and found in the end none of the eternal promises. But in Jacob's life, things were very different. The angels of God never left him. And he goes his way now, not towards Edom, but towards Succoth, and there for a while rests. And in verse 18 of chapter 33, if we pick up the record from that point, we find that Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. In fact, it probably should better be translated as it is in most other versions. Jacob came in peace to the city Shechem. Shalem has been turned into a proper name here, but it probably should be translated as in peace. So Jacob came in peace to the city of Shechem. And isn't it interesting what is appended to that? He didn't just move down from Peniel where he was to Shechem, which was not a very great distance. What we find here is that the divine record tells us that now this is in the land of Canaan. This is where God was bringing him back to. This is the point that Abraham had come to first when he was in the land. Shechem was the first stopping point of Abraham when he first came into the land. But not only that, it tells us when he came from Padan Aram. Now we know he'd come from Padan Aram. We know that he'd been on his way for some time, probably months, getting to this point. So why tell us that here? And why tell us now that he pitched his tent? Why? Well, it's clearly linking some of those references in Abraham's life. Where Abraham first pitched his tent and where Abraham came from the land of Haran and Padan Aram through to here and first dwelt in the land of Canaan. It's highlighting his commitment to the promises. The reason he's come back into this place and not stayed where he was, because he wants to resume again the life of a stranger and a pilgrim that was committed to all the promises that his father Abraham and his father Isaac had learned to love and that he himself had wanted above all other things. You know, brothers and sisters, it's very interesting from here that we find Jacob retracing Abraham's steps. This is not an accident in the record. You remember that Abraham came out of the land of Ur and he went up to Haran in the region of Syria. And then he came down and the next thing we find is that he's in Shechem. And what we find in Abraham's circumstances, he made a decision at that point to live a life of a pilgrim. And he moves down to Bethel. And from Bethel eventually, after some wandering, he moves to Hebron. And that's exactly where we're going to find Jacob going. He's told to come, or he moves down into Shechem first. And all those references which highlight the pilgrim and stranger life of Abraham are here said of him when he arrives. And we know that he goes on to Bethel. And then finally, the story ends with him in Hebron, just like the patriarch Abraham. And you remember when he was before living back at home, before the incident with Esau and himself that caused him to flee, he went to Bethel to try and find the God that Abraham had found, and he found him there. He found the same power of that God that was there, and it inspired him, the vision that was given to him, that inspired him all his days through that long period of probation, and now he's following back and coming and settling in exactly the same way, following the steps of Abraham. You know, brothers and sisters, the interesting thing about Jacob's life is this, and it's very relevant to us as well, that his probation didn't end when he learnt the lesson of Peniel, and neither does ours. When finally we come to realise that we should not be struggling with external forces, but and fighting against God's providential hand, but working with it and learning to trust. Our probation doesn't end at that point, and neither did Jacob's. In fact, that was the point at which God, in this man's life, really started to use him. And often it was in unexpected ways. And things don't go all smoothly from this point on, even though he's been through the experience of fighting with the angel and realizing that he must look into the face of that angel, realizing his own weakness and understanding that he's got to let go and trust in God's providential hand in his life. So we find his life goes on, and we're privileged to have some more details of his life from this point. But we realize here in verse 19 that Jacob was clearly of the mindset of the patriarchs of faith, because he wanted to maintain some separation. We notice at the end of verse 18 that he pitched his tent before the city. He didn't go into the city of Shechem. He came to that area because it was a significant area as far as Abraham's life was concerned. But he didn't go into that city. He pitched outside of it, and he's in a tent. And verse 19 says, and he bought a parcel of the field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. He bought a parcel of land upon which, verse 20 tells us, he erected an altar. He didn't want reliance on the world, and what he did, in fact, he bought a parcel of land that had already previously been bought by Abraham. Acts 7, Stephen in Acts 7 tells us that. So Abraham had previously built an altar at this place too, and now he comes back here and he buys that same piece of land and he sets up an altar. And verse 20 says, when in erecting this altar, he called it El Eloah Israel. Now, you know, he'd only just been told his name is going to be changed to Israel, and now he himself is using this term, Israel. It wasn't clearly a commonly used term as we tend to think. So for him to call this El Eloah Israel shows what he's thinking. He's linking it back to that experience with the angel and his name change, the promise of his name change, even though you notice up until now his name's not called in the record Israel. And it's not for some time before he actually gets called Israel in the record. There's more to happen before God is going to label him completely with that new name. But it indicates the level of thinking that he has. Now remember that Jacob is at this point still limping, no doubt. He's got a permanent reminder of his own weakness. And when he comes to that place, he goes as a stranger and buys that little plot of land and puts an altar there and calls it the strength of the mighty ones of the Prince of God? Where was the strength of the mighty ones of the Prince of God? It's no longer in himself, and he realizes that. And that's why he called that older that. He now knew that the only strength he had was in God. He'd learnt that lesson on the mount at Peniel. And here, finally, he erects an altar and acknowledges that and worships God in those circumstances with that frame of mind. You know, brothers and sisters, God could have chosen to just cut the record of Jacob's life there. And we would have had this sort of cycle where he'd learnt this lesson finally that all of us have to learn in life. But the story doesn't stop there. In fact, the story goes right through to the end of Genesis. And of course, we're not going to deal with all that. But immediately, at that very moment, you think at the point when he's finally learned the greatest lesson that God was trying to teach him in his life and has changed his thinking to realize that he can't trust in himself and that he ought to put his trust in the living God, the God of Bethel, who had revealed himself in all the angelic host so wonderfully in that vision of Bethel. We find that in chapter 34... that Dinah, the daughter of Leah, went out to see the daughters of the land. And an absolute tragedy in Jacob's life came upon him again. And again, it's through all the just, simple, domestic, family circumstances that were just ordinary occurrences. Dinah, seeking some female company, went out into the world and walked straight into temptation with disastrous results. She was flattered and enticed, and Shechem, the prince of the land, spoke to her heart, and disaster ensued. And Jacob's now left in this terrible situation where his daughter's been defiled. And what does he to do? He's left in indecision. He doesn't know what to do. In fact, he's just turns to God, and we don't really hear of him again. He just disappears out of the record of chapter 34. And the sons of Jacob come to the fore now. The brothers of Dinah come to the fore. They're called here the sons of Jacob. And they take charge. And they saw the issues, I suppose, in some sense from an actual worldly point of view. They saw the issues much more clearly than Jacob did. And they were very decisive. They weren't going to let their sister be treated like this. And the Syrian immediately merges in his sons. And Jacob despairs to see it. There in his own house, the Syrian characteristics rise up in his sons. And they take things into their own hands. And they deal with the people of the land. They deceive them and slay them. And right at the end of that chapter, after Jacob has just gone through a tragedy, anguish of mind, he says in verse 30, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, who were the instigators of this, "You have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." You know, it was just a moment when everything overwhelmed him. And temporarily he forgot that the angel was there again, the promise of protection. But it wasn't long again before he lifted and God appeared to him almost immediately after this, chapter 35, verse 1. God said to Jacob, "Arise and go." And you think, well, why is God still working with him when he keeps falling back into this despair? But you know, brothers and sisters, that is the experience of our lives. It's been written for us. This is not going to help Jacob, these words on a page. It's not going to help anyone else but future generations. Because at times, brothers and sisters, though we think we've learned the lesson to not trust in ourselves and to put our confidence in God, though we think we've learnt it at times and experiences take us through the deep valleys of life and we come out the other side feeling as though we are thankful that God has taught us all these lessons, only to find that something else comes into our lives and we can't actually cope immediately. Our natural reaction is to go into despair. But God was able to work through even those circumstances. Because God used the actions of Simeon and Levi here, which, as Jacob said, made his name to stink among the inhabitants. God used it to protect Jacob, not to bring the nations down so they'd slay them. They were afraid of them. And by the providential circumstances that came about as a result of that, God protected them. He used the evil of Jacob's sons for protection for the whole family. And yet, here God is not finished with this man. There was a promise of protection and guidance that God had originally given him in Bethel. And God was leading him back inevitably to that point. And it turns out to be a whole cycle in his life, because now God in verse 1 of chapter 35 says, "Arise and go back up to Bethel and dwell there. Come back to the place and make there an altar unto Aaron that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother." And so God is telling him, here is the cycle of your life, Jacob. I want you to come right back full circle to the point at which you started this probation where I sent you off to Syria, in which time you've learned all these lessons of life. And he had. There's no question about that. It seems that Jacob may well have been content to dwell at Shechem, at least for a time. But now God says, no, I want you to come back. I want you to go back now to the house of God. And what a contrast there was to the first time and he visited. He came there and the first time running from Esau and fearful for his life, and he as a single man. And now he returns with two bands of people. He returns in the promise that God had said to him, "I'll be with you and bring you all the way until I've finished with you." So he's got all of that history behind him, and the confidence that God has actually fulfilled his word to that point and brought him back to here. But he came at that first instance to Bethel as Jacob the supplanter, and now truly he comes back. This time God calls him to Bethel as Israel, the prince with God. And so there's a 40-year period in here, a period that is typical of his whole life. It wasn't his whole life, brethren and sisters, but it's a typical period in his life where God has been transforming this man and preparing him for the glory to come. You remember the words of Hosea. Hosea said, he strove with the messenger, the angel, at Peniel. And he prevailed when he wept and made supplication unto him. And we saw that particular circumstance and experience of his yesterday when we looked at that together. But Hosea goes on to say, and at Bethel he found him. It doesn't say at Peniel he found it. It says at Bethel. And so Hosea, reading the divine record here and under inspiration, says that Jacob had gone through this great journey that God had taken him on into Syria. And it wasn't until he got back to Bethel that he finally found God in the ultimate and fullest sense. And Hosea says, and there he spake with us. So there's something here, brethren and sisters, by the time Jacob gets back to Bethel, that's of very great significance for us. Well, what's the lesson? Well, God calls him back to Bethel. Now, you know where he is at the moment as we start chapter 35. Remember, he's still based at Shechem when this call comes for him to go up. And Jacob does not immediately go to Bethel. Look at verse 2. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, Put away the strange gods that are among you and be clean and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I'll make there an altar unto Ael, who answered me in the day of my distress and was with me in the way which I went." Isn't that a marvelous description of how Jacob saw that whole thing? He knew that it was the day of distress when he first arrived there. He now calls upon his family to rise and prepare to go up to Bethel, because he was going up there to set up an altar to honor the God that had been with him all the way in which he'd gone. So he's got his perspective of God's overshadowing hand in his life. But you know, brothers and sisters, the single message to start with that Jacob himself gives his own house, and notice that it's applied to, he said unto his household, verse 2, and to all that were with him, that is to typically the household of Israel and all those who were attached, all the Gentiles, so it includes us in here. And so this lesson that's speaking to us is not just being spoken to Israel. And the message he said to them in a nutshell was, before we can go up to the house of God, we've got to leave the world behind. Now, they had already left Syria and they're on their way back to the promised land. And now, as he gets this final call to go up to the house of God, where he's going to meet with God and worship him there and build an altar to him, there, at that point, Jacob says to his whole house, we've got to leave behind all the strange gods, all the gods of the alien, Rotherham says, foreign gods, says the RSV. And you know, brothers and sisters, those same foreign gods were in Jacob's house are with us still today. You know, Jacob was utterly amazed at how many gods there were still in his house, even though he'd left the land of idolatry and had headed back to the promised land to live in tents as a pilgrim and a stranger. There were gods in his own house. In fact, his own wife had gods that she'd hidden. And what were those gods all about? Well, the gods that she had were these teraphim, which represent the title deeds of property. Now, that's interesting, isn't it, too, brothers and sisters? Because what are the gods that are in our houses? Things that consume our time, things that give us a false sense of security, things that please the flesh. All of those are the characteristics of idols. And they're still there today, brothers and sisters. They're in our houses. They're in our stuff and our entertainments and the technology that pervades our lives. It's all still with us, just like it was in Jacob's house. And much of that stuff has nothing to do with the truth. In fact, it's going to have a very, very big and detrimental effect on getting us up finally to the house of God. And look what Jacob says in what it says about what they did in verse 4. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods that were in their hand and in their earrings, and all their earrings which were in their ears. So there were, excuse me, two sorts of gods here, two sorts of things that were distractions. There were things that were in their hands. There were things that affected their activity, that affected what they were doing. And there were things that were in their ears. There were things that were affecting their minds. And those two things are still in the ecclesial house today, brethren and sisters. We would have to be foolish to deny that they're there. Because the gods of the aliens are having a debilitating effect upon the ecclesia of God today and upon our children. Well, what happened to Jacob's wife? Because we know that Rachel had within her possession teraphim that she hid from Laban, who was after them before that to get them. And they were still in her house. Now, whether she gave them up at this point, we don't know. But we know this, that shortly after they left Bethel, she died in the way before she got to Hebron. to complete fellowship with God. So what does Jacob say in verse 2? He said, be clean, the end of verse 2, and change your garments. Be clean talks about moral cleanliness, a cleanliness of the heart. Clean up your hearts and change your garments. That's got to be seen in an outward way of life and actions that's going to be manifest from that. It's no good doing one or the other. It's got to be both. We've got to purge our hearts, and Jacob knew that, which is why he gives that exhortation. Because Jacob saw the issues of probation very clearly here, and he took control of the circumstance with his whole family. You know, it's really fascinating from an expositional point of view that they were still at this point in Shechem. You know the significance of Shechem in the scriptures, brethren and sisters? Repeatedly, over and over again, it becomes a site at which major decisions were taken. We find that that's the very first place where Abraham comes into the land and he decides that he's going to stay, and he set his tent and went down towards Bethel. So he made a decision at that point. Now we know here, Jacob is also making a pretty significant decision. We know when Israel came into the land, they were taken to Ebal and Gerem, to the very place of Shechem, and there read the cursings and blessings and told to decide. And the very end of Joshua's life, Joshua takes the people there to Shechem again. He says, I'm going to meet you at Shechem. Let's turn there, Joshua 24, because it's connected to this part of Jacob's life. But a major decision was taken at this point. And so it went on through Israel's history, Shechem becoming the point of decision making. Joshua 24, verse 14. Now therefore, fear Yahweh and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve Yahweh. And if it seem evil unto you to serve Yahweh, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether it's the God of your fathers that you served on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. So there was a decision that he was calling upon the nation to make at that stage. He says, put away these foreign gods, these strange gods, just like Jacob had said, and learn with sincerity and truth. Clean your hearts and change your garments, said Jacob. And Joshua said virtually the same thing. You know what the people said in verse 16? They answered and said, oh, God forbid that we should forsake Yahweh and serve other gods. For Yahweh, our God, he it is that brought us out of the land of our fathers, out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. And, oh, God has done all these wonderful things for us. Look at verse 19. And Joshua said to them, you cannot serve Yahweh, for he is an holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions and your sins. If ye forsake Yahweh and serve strange gods, then he will turn you and do you hurt and consume you after that you've done you good. You know, Joshua didn't actually believe them. He said, you can't serve, even though you're saying you want to serve. And of course, you think that you're serving him. And they said in verse 21, nay, but we will serve Yahweh. So Joshua said to them, all right then, verse 23, now, you say you're going to serve Yahweh? Verse 23, now therefore put away the strange gods which are among you, Jacob's words, and incline your heart unto Yahweh, God of Israel. You know what Joshua was saying? Despite all that they'd said in this two-way conversation with Joshua at the time, Joshua is saying to them, you say you're going to serve Yahweh and him only. I'm telling you, you can't. And they say, well, you can, we will, we want to. He said, no, you can't. He'll destroy you. They said, why? And he said, because the gods are still there. They deceived themselves. They were saying, yes, we'll serve Yahweh. And they hadn't realized that the strange gods were still in their house. And it took all of this two-way conversation to finally get to the point where Joshua said, right, if you're going to do this, go and get them and bring them out here and we'll get rid of them. We find in verse 26, and Joshua wrote these words, the covenant that they'd made to serve God with all their heart, wrote these words in the book of the law of God and took a great stone and set it there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of Yahweh. Now, whether he actually did exactly what Jacob did, we don't know. But there's two interesting things mentioned in verse 26. And they are the oak, under which he set up a great stone to memorialize that this was the point at which they'd put away all their strange gods. And there's the sanctuary that's mentioned. Now, that's exactly what we find in Jacob's time. Because Jacob, there's an oak mentioned here when Jacob is at Shechem. And there's another oak talked about a little further on. But there's also a sanctuary, that is the altar, which Jacob had built here at Shechem, which probably was the very same thing that Joshua was talking about. So Joshua is hearkening back to the oak under which they had buried. Now come back to Genesis for a moment, because let's see what Jacob did with them. The end of verse 4, after they'd given him all these strange gods, after finally they'd come up and out of their houses, Jacob hid them under the oak that was at Shechem. The very same place that Joshua later went back to and erected that monument to say, here we're going to record exactly the same spirit of our father Jacob, who buried all of this under this oak. And there was, at that very same point, was this altar that we'd already read about that he had made at Shechem. So what was this oak? You know, oaks in those days, brothers and sisters, became landmarks, and they were solitary trees, and because of their solitary nature, people used them as direction points, but they also stood out and therefore became very good symbols of some principle which was to be enunciated or connected to it. And here, the principle of separation was being established by Jacob. You know, Jacob didn't go and sell those idols. He buried them. He buried them under the ground where they belonged. And the lesson that he was trying to teach his family, that Joshua later was trying to teach the nation, is that if we are going to go up to the house of God, and soon all of us, brothers and sisters, are going to be called there, we cannot go with the gods of foreigners in our tents. We're not going to be able to take all that stuff with us. Nor are we going to be able to take the baggage of all that in our heads with us either. Because we'll find that we just don't belong at the house of God, if such is the case. And so we find that Jacob in verse 5, and they journeyed. They moved on now, having dealt with that very issue. One of the issues that we also are meant to learn, as Hosea said, the putting away of all the gods of the nations, the gods of strange foreign gods, before we move up to the house of God finally. And the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. And so Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people that were with him, just according to as the promise had been given. This was a journey of faith, and now a pilgrim of thankfulness is in progress as they move towards Bethel to acknowledge God's blessings and his guidance and to worship and thank him at that point. You know, it's intriguing in passing that the name of Luz, which is the earlier name given to the town that was near where Bethel was, is mentioned here. And the name has a number of different meanings, one of which is perverseness or waywardness. And perhaps that's just reminding us that that's the way in which Jacob first came to that spot. And he named it the house of God, But now he's back according to God's promise, and all the people, all the blessing of God surrounding him. And truly for him, it was no longer waywardness, but in fact the house of God. And verse 7, and there he built an altar and called the place Ael Beth Ael, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. He now renames this sanctuary at Bethel. He names it Ael Beth Ael, the strength of the house of God. It's not just the house of God as it was to him before because he'd seen all the angels. Now he had, by experience, had come to realize that the strength of the house of God lay not in man, not in him, not in his might, but in the mercy and faithfulness of the only one and true God. You know, we could easily jump across the next verse and come to verse 9 because God appeared unto Jacob again there when he got out of Padan Aram. But there's an interesting little aside here in verse 8 that seems to have nothing to do with the record. But in actual fact, clearly it does. Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, died and was buried beneath Bethel under the oak. Another oak now, this one in Bethel. And the name of it was called Allonbacuth. What's it all about? Well, Deborah was Rebecca's wet nurse that had left Syria with Rebecca 117 years earlier. So she was a very, very old lady. She had brought up Rebecca as a baby, and she must have been in excess of 160 years of age at this time. And it's quite possible that she'd been sent back to Padan Aram with the news of Rebecca's death, and now she joins Jacob's company. We don't really know how she got into Jacob's company, but that may have been how she did. And she's there in that company, no doubt caring for the grandchildren, was evidently an old lady who was very much loved amongst the family. And Allonbacuth means the oak of weeping. And there was weeping because of the loss of this dear old lady who had served as a maid for so many years in that family and had supported the lives of the patriarchs. But she symbolizes in this story, brothers and sisters, Jacob's last connection to his mother. Historically, this woman was linked to Rebecca in her immaturity as a Syrian, and now finally that last connection back to his Syrian roots passes away. It was as if, now, this is just saying that here at this very point, the Syrian influence is put down out of Jacob's life. It's not that in reality the flesh had gone, but in symbol. And at that point, God appeared. You notice in verse 9, God appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall thy name be. And he called his name Israel. Now, he'd already been told that by the angel before. But now it's repeated. And still, he doesn't actually get this name. It's not until even a little later that he is actually called by the name of Israel. But verse 11 goes on to say, and God said unto him, I am God Almighty, I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come out of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. I am El Shaddai. And it's now at this point, brethren and sisters, that the angel who's here talking with him, because we know without any question that there was an angel here that's talking to him face to face. Because in verse 13 it says, and God went up from him from the place where he talked with him. And it's repeated again in verse 14 and in verse 15. This was a personal contact that he had. And clearly it wasn't with God himself. It was with God's representative. It was with the angel. And probably the very same angel that he'd fought with on the previous occasion when he was at Peniel. And now that angel comes back to him and reiterates that same promise that your name is going to be changed from Jacob to Israel. And now the angel reveals his name. You remember he wouldn't tell him his name before. And now he reveals his name. And he says he was the personal representative of God himself, manifested as El Shaddai, the captain of the host of all the angels. That's who it was that was standing alongside of him that he'd actually fought with. The very captain of all the angelic host. And this angel speaks in the first person and says, I am God Almighty. He was representing God in manifestation in this way. And the name to the patriarchs and right through the historical part of Genesis, brethren and sisters, we find this term, El Shaddai, representing the power of God to nourish and protect and to care and to provide for the seed. And it's always linked in its usage to the fruitfulness and the multiplicity and the care that God had for the seed. And now the angel comes back to him and says, I'm going to change your name now, as we've said before. You're going to be a prince with God because you've come to learn those lessons. And I am the great angel that has been working with you to nourish and care and protect. And now that you've come full circle right back, starting from Bethel and have come right back to Bethel and have understood all the principles that are involved in that time of probation, Jacob. Now you can see fully my work. You can see who I am and why I was doing all this. And Jacob could. Jacob's experience through all that way right up to the point that he finally stands in Bethel again could appreciate the marvelous hand of that angel. And all that God was doing in him, and that was now embedded in this name, El Shaddai, that God had put upon this angel. And this angel now restates the promises that had already previously been given to him and enlarges the promises so that now it's not only just going to be a nation that comes from him, but a company of nations, an ecclesia that's worldwide that's going to go beyond the borders of Israel, and kings. Kings, where has that ever occurred in the promises before? Kings are going to come from thee. The saints in glory, he's now in prospect talking about. It's quite amazing that now, once he gets to this point in his life and has experienced the changes that God has been making, and he's now at the point where the name of Israel, of Prince with God, is able to be put upon him. You know, brothers and sisters, with a lot of biblical names, they can actually be, in the Hebrew, taken in two different ways that have slightly different meanings, but essentially the same meaning. For example, Daniel can be, in Hebrew, the judgment of God, or God is my judge, or any other combination of those two words, because the two Hebrew words from which Daniel is made are God, or El, and judgment. And here we have his name Israel, which we normally associate with God, being a prince with God, a ruler with God. But you know, the Hebrew is also capable of being understood as God rules. Now, those two things are not actually very different, because what God was really trying to teach Jacob all his life is to let God rule in his life. And when finally God was able to rule in his life, then he was fit, in fact, to be a ruler with God and not before. While our own selfishness and our own natural inclinations drive us, brethren and sisters, while we are ruling our own spirit and we are the masters of our own destiny, God has no work for us. We will never be a ruler with God, a prince with God, until such time that God is able to rule in us. And now, full circle has come in Jacob's life. He's finally allowed God to rule. And now he's ready to have the name placed upon him. Verse 13, and God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. God went up from him. Why did God go up from him? Why did the angel leave him? Well, in actual fact, it never did. But in a typical sense, The angel had come down and said, I'll be with you in all the way until I have finished that with which I have promised unto thee. And from Bethel, right back to Bethel, that probation period had taken place. And now, in a typical sense, God had completed his work. His name was changed to Israel. The transformation had taken place. The work of God was complete. And in a typical sense, God went up as if the work was finished. Now, we know in his life there was actually another 40 years of Jacob's life left. And he lived that out. But he found God finally in Bethel. In this place, after that long period of transformation, he'd finally come to let God rule in his life. And at that point, he became a prince with God. He found God at last at that point in Bethel, which is what Hosea says. And there he spoke with us. You know, God first revealed himself to Jacob by the word spoken, and then in a vision. And here, finally, at Bethel, he speaks to him face to face. You know, brothers and sisters, that's the experience of our lives. In the early part of our lives, we hear the word of God and we develop a vision. And God will help us to develop that vision. But the reality of that cycle of probation in our life is that finally we will see him face to face. And he will speak with us. And the angel will go up from us, in a sense, after we have been through the judgment process, because the work will have finished. Life will go on, just as Jacob's did. But the work that God is doing of transformation in our life will finally be complete. It's an absolutely marvellous picture, isn't it? As one writer said, here finally, Jacob became Israel. The man who had learned at last that God and only God is the master of the destiny of all his chosen ones, and that the only part they themselves can play with success in that destiny is through faith and prayer. And when finally he'd learned that lesson, brothers and sisters, he'd found God. He'd found the God he'd been looking for. His life goes on from here, amidst sometimes great tragedy. We know that he went up to Hebron and there he dwelt for a while. It tells us that he was living as a stranger and a pilgrim. And we might think that now everything would be fine and prosperous and time of blessing and harmony and happiness with his family. They're finally back united in the land. But the next 40 years were agonizing as well. The one bright spot in his life, the one and one only godly son that he had, was taken by the others and killed, so to speak. His sons deceived him and hid it for 20 years from him and left him in grief to bear that. And famine comes and hardship and tension in the family. And then he goes off to Egypt and finally meets with his son again. And there's peace and consolation in those last few years of his life. But you know, through all that period of trauma, brothers and sisters, we see a different Jacob than the early part of his life. In fact, we see an Israel, because he's called Israel during that period. We see a prince with God. We see a man in whom God was ruling, no longer scheming, no longer fighting against the angel. In anguish and pain, that's for sure, in suffering, but trusting and waiting on God, the God he'd found at Bethel. And he never, never let go of that vision of those angels or of the personal appearance of El Shaddai that was there with a promise to care and to nourish. And at times he couldn't see, like all of us, where God was leading him. But he had learned to patiently endure in well-doing until the day that God had brought the blessing. You know, that's the way the latter part of Genesis paints Jacob's life. And we know it's how he thought. Because I'd like you to come to the end of his life in chapter 48 of Genesis. chapter 48 and at verse 15. And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed, shepherded, it should be, the God which shepherded me all my life long unto this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. You know who said that, brethren and sisters? Look a couple of verses up, verse 14. And Israel stretched out his right hand and said, it's not Jacob. This is truly Israel, a prince with God, who looking back across his life saw that in every single circumstance of his life, God was shepherding him all the way. And the angel had always been there, though he'd been fighting with him at times, and had redeemed him from all that evil, redeemed him out of it. And he'd learned in that latter part of his life to trust the angel, not on his own judgment. And there he speaks with us, brothers and sisters, to learn the same lesson. The Jacob, the Syrian ready to perish, had truly been transformed into a prince with God. But listen to the words finally of Hosea. Let Hosea have the last say, because he summarizes his life. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. He had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him, and he found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. Even Yahweh, Elohim of hosts, Yahweh is his memorial. And here is the lesson. Therefore, turn thou to thy God. Keep mercy and judgment, and wait on thy God continually. May it be that the experiences of this man and the experiences of the greater Jacob, who likewise through great crying and tears learned from the things he suffered, be an inspiration and an anchor for our faith in these last days as we wait for the appearance of our Master to take us all up to the house of God.